Hi, this is Bill Gray at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado, north of Denver, about 65 miles. You're listening to Weather Brains.
This time on Weather Brains. Ever tried capturing lightning with your camera? Harold Aidens has plenty of experience at it. And in a Weather Brains extra, Catching the Flash, he shares some tips on how he does it.
It's not uncommon for me, like a good storm. I might shoot 3-4 rolls of film even.
Plus, you may also be interested to hear what Harold does for his job. It has to do with, you guessed it, lightning.
We have several instruments here, the most important being the lightning mapping array.
Also this time,
you never know when you're going to be in exactly the right spot where something big happens, and nobody's going to know about it if you don't record it.
If you're fascinated by weather and you're looking for an innovative way to help your community, we'll tell you how you can do it. Plus, as you go up in the atmosphere, the temperature drops, right? Well, not always. On Weather Brains 101, Professor Peters explains inversions. And on This Week in Weather History with Bill Murray, Texas residents remember Hurricanes Celia and Allen. It's the anniversary of a devastating Texas airline crash in which weather was a factor. And folks in Colorado recall one of the deadliest natural disasters in American history. It's all coming up. Don't you go away. It's the 79th consecutive episode of Weather Brains, the show that's all about weather, produced by The Weather Company. I'm David Black. Hello, and thank you for being with us. On this ride is J.B. Elliott and Brian Peters. J.B., how are you, sir?
I am semi-short on sleep. Otherwise, I am in good shape and happy.
Well, you have an active life, so you need to get some sleep. Otherwise, you drag during the day. That's my advice for this show.
Yes.
All right. Brian Peters, you're with us, too. You're out of jail. You're free. There are no active warrants. I'm impressed. How did you... Why do I do
man,
that to you?
How do you pass up an introduction like that, JB? You know, I'm...
I don't know.
How many times a day do you beat your wife?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I just can't resist. But I trust you are well, Mr. Peters.
I am doing very well, and the proud owner of 43/100ths of an inch of rain yesterday. And when you're in the semi-arid southeastern United States, 43/100ths is like gold. I even sat on my porch and watched it rain. Talk about boring, huh?
Well, and you think about people in the central U.S. who've been, you know, floating away. They're probably hearing 43 going, wow, big deal. We're excited for you there. We just need some type of system of even distribution, and everybody will be happy. But
and you know, speaking of distribution, David, you know, one of the things about weather that I think is so just appealing to me is that how much variation there can be. And I know we originate this show in Central Alabama, but we got an email from somebody that I don't think they've ever emailed before. But in a shower yesterday, they had 4.7 inches of rain.
Just a light shower?
No, not exactly. But it's like, I mean, I got 43/100ths. They got 10 times what I got. Hmm. And it just, I don't know. That's one of the appeals of weather is just how much it varies. And
you know, we've had funny cases, too. You guys know more about this than I do, where folks living in the, let's say, in the southeastern U.S. might be in unseasonably cool weather, but because of the positioning, and you correct me if I'm wrong on this, the positioning of a ridge, it might be like record high 90s to 100 in states well to the northwest, like up in the northern U.S. Just crazy.
Hey, that's part of my discussion tonight. In fact, there were 20 locations in Montana today with 100 or hotter.
We need to call somebody up in Montana and say, what's it like for you to have weather like that? Maybe some of them are used to it, and maybe some of them are going nuts. But
yes,
it's never a dull moment for weather. And speaking of weather, something that I've been seeing lately prompts us to do something kind of unusual for this episode of Weather Brains. A lot of folks have cameras. They're out taking pictures of everything in the world, including weather. It's really become quite an interesting pastime for some folks. Nothing happens for a while, and then a quick flash of action. No, I'm not talking about Brian Peters actually getting up off the couch and working for a switch. We're talking about what it's like to take pictures of lightning.
in the age of these low-cost digital cameras that everybody's getting, more and more folks are giving lightning photography a try. And we're seeing that on some websites where people post pictures and such. But there are some tricks to making it work. And Harold Aidens knows the tricks. Harold's website, weatherscapes.com, is full of spectacular pictures of lightning and other weather phenomena. You need to check it out. Harold's originally from the Netherlands, but we caught up with him where he lives and works in the mountains of New Mexico. And where he works will be of interest to weather geeks as well. Harold, you see, is working on his PhD in lightning research as a graduate assistant at the Langmuir Laboratory for Atmospheric Research. Now, that's part of the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology. Harold has been shooting lightning for 15 years. So it's a Weather Brains Extra we've got for you this time called Catching the Flash. How did you get into photographing lightning and other elements of the weather?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. So I've been asking myself that over the 15 past years, and I think...
You grew up in the Netherlands.
I grew up in the Netherlands, and my father was a photographer, and I just happened to grow into lightning and weather. I don't know exactly how this happened, but I remember being terrified of lightning when I was a little kid. I remember that very well. And that someday, I think, I watched a storm together with my mom and my sister. And my sister saw some wicked lightning, and I didn't see a thing. I just saw a flash. And, you know, I was so annoyed that I didn't see that, and my sister did see that. I just went out to look for another storm when another storm came later. And I think I just saw lightning, and that was so pretty that, you know, that was it.
So you started shooting it at a very early age.
Yeah, I think I started when I was around 14 years old or something, yeah.
You have a gorgeous website. You have fabulous photographs of lightning and a lot of other
types of
weather. I enjoyed your gravity waves and other photographs you've taken.
Oh, yeah.
If for people who want to take pictures of lightning, and perhaps they've just recently acquired a digital camera, this is obviously something that you're not necessarily just going to hold up a camera and take a picture real quick and get it. What do people need to know? What do we need to learn to try to make this work?
Well, yeah, so the most important thing is obviously safety. And that may be a bit boring because I'm not going to get to the point right away. But
it's a good point not to get outside in the open to do this. Right.
Yes. You have to make sure that you understand lightning a bit and that you know when you're safe and when not. So one example that you're not safe is out in the open on a field or a hill or something. Near trees, near power lines, fences, things like that. So I would suggest if you go out, take picture of lightning, go out in a car and stay in a car if lightning is close. And close is like closer than 10 miles.
Is that how you do it?
Yes. Well, I'm experienced with looking at storms, so I know when I'm safe and when I'm not. But I would say lightning closer than 10 miles away, you start running risk of, you know, being in danger. So for somebody who's not experienced, I would say just photograph lightning from a small distance, like 10, 20 miles. It's pretty then usually, so you get good, you can get good photos, and you're safe. Now, if you want to photograph lightning when it's closer, then I would recommend sitting in a car. And, you know, you have your car, and you have the camera just outside the car. I get to that now. And you just operate the camera from within your car. So if lightning were to strike, then at least you're safe. So now,
this is a pretty fast event to capture, so how do we do that?
Yeah, so that I've heard many people wonder how I'm able to capture lightning that quickly. You know, how can you trigger the shutters that quickly? So the answer is you don't do that. You photograph lightning during the night. So there's no light, so you can keep the shutter of your camera open for a couple seconds, minutes, maybe longer.
Now, if you're going to keep your shutter open, you need to be able to control how much light is coming in, right?
Right, so yeah. Basically, you can... Nowadays, you have digital cameras. You can control shutter speed. You can control your sensitivity, the ISO number, and you can control the aperture of your lens. Now, little compact cameras, you cannot do most of these things, but with a prosumer or professional camera, you can. So you can control how much light gets in by changing the aperture of the lens.
Okay, so what I'm hearing from you then, Harold, is if I were to purchase a camera in the very low-end price range at a discount store, I'm not going to have as much luck shooting lightning with a camera like that.
That's right. Well, you could get lucky, but, you know, the camera is going to make all decisions for you, and the camera most cameras are not made to photograph lightning during the night, so okay. they may mess up their settings. But
so if I spend the money for a little more of expensive camera where I can control settings and shutter speeds, that's a better thing to do.
Yeah, it depends a bit on, like, if you want to just try lighting photography, you know, someday, but you're not really into it, then you can try with a compact camera, any range. But if you're really serious about, like, night photography and lightning, I would recommend, like, a prosumer camera. Yeah.
So if I have a camera that would allow me to shoot the way that you're talking about, to vary my shutter speed, I would take long exposures, and I would probably lower the amount of light coming in during that time.
Okay, first of all, you need a tripod for your camera.
That's critical. Okay.
Yeah, so because you're going to be exposing, you know, maybe half a minute, 1 minute, and that depends on where you are. But say you're like out in the open in the country land, you can maybe expose for a couple minutes before it really the picture starts exposing itself.
Is that how you've gotten some of your pictures, some of the best ones?
Yeah. Many of my best photos are made like exposing 2-3 minutes and almost nothing happens, and then suddenly, you know, boom, and lightning is there, and lightning is going to illuminate the clouds and the ground and all that, so then the picture's made. And, you know, how bright lightning is going to be in your picture, you don't know. You just have to guess.
So in other words, I'm guessing you've taken a lot of pictures that you didn't necessarily keep because they weren't as good, but you had a lot of good ones out of those that you shot.
Oh, yes. It's not uncommon for me. Like a good storm, I might shoot, like what, 3-4 rolls of film even in a couple hours, and then maybe there's like 3-4 keepers. Like, yeah.
Okay, so you shoot
that are really nice.
You shoot a lot more than you keep. You're talking film. I know you shot film for a long time. Are you all digital now?
No, I'm still film. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, and I would like to take opportunity to talk about that a bit.
Okay. Because I figured you would be in the digital generation too.
Yeah, and most people are, and I'm starting to not even mention anymore that I'm with film, because most people think I'm getting old or something. But,
well, why do you shoot film over digital?
Right, well, there's a very good reason to shoot film, and that's, I shoot a slide, by the way. That's because digital sensors are very linear in their response with light. And when you overexpose a shot, like, for instance, the sun is in the image, or a lightning bolt, you're going to have nasty clippings there. Clipping mean, like, you're going to see a clear separation between overexposed, blown-out highlights and the properly exposed parts of the image.
So you're saying film really does a better job of shooting things like lightning?
Right, because film is like more, it's less linear in its response with overexposing light. So if you see a lightning bolt on film, I think it looks much better than on digital. So that's not to say that you shouldn't try digital, because digital can be very good with lightning. Depends on the kind of lightning you're going to shoot. But for people who are just starting, I definitely recommend to just use a digital camera. Can be a simple one, a compact camera even. Just set it on its night setting, whatever, and, you know, shoot away, and then you might get something, and it's gonna look good. But, you know, if you really want the highest quality, then I would still recommend film. Yeah.
I would see one advantage with digital in that if you're gonna shoot a lot of pictures that you're not gonna keep, you can always just delete those off your card, and you haven't used up any of your space.
That's really important, and also, you can see right away if your exposure is correct, and that's really important with lightning, because with lightning it's always a bit of a guess what your correct exposure settings are going to be, you know. And really, the only you want to set your camera on the lowest ISO number, the lowest sensitivity, because that's the highest resolution, lowest noise. So the only thing you have control over really is the aperture of the lens. Now, setting that correctly is going to have, you know, you need to be experienced in choosing correct aperture,
which means trial and error.
Right, and with film, that can be a long trial. You know, you shoot in a storm, and, you know, you mess it up, and that's it. It's not like a studio. You can go back and try again. So there, I really recommend a digital for people who are just starting, because, you know,
right.
Yeah, it makes it so much easier.
What pictures are you the proudest of that you've captured lightning with?
Oh, well, two come to mind right away, and one was taken in New Orleans. It was a very slow storm. It was growing very slowly, and sometimes these storms, they grow so slowly that they can start outputting a certain type of lightning called bolt from the blue.
And this lightning is not, it just doesn't come out of the cloud base. It just jumps out of the side of the cloud, makes a large, you know, loop, and then just hits the ground a bit away from the storm. So that was one photo I took that I'm really proud of. And the other one was a little storm in May here in New Mexico. The monsoon wasn't even here yet. It was just a little storm. Rushed out, set up my camera. And, you know, the cloud-to-ground lighting was so predictable in location that I just put the lens, the camera on portrait mode, like vertical. And there came a bolt, boom, right in the middle of my frame. And that,
wow.
That was a really nice image, yes.
How close has lightning struck to you when you were shooting?
While I was shooting, well...
Too close for comfort?
Okay, well, lightning has struck 6 feet distant from me one time.
6 feet away?
Yeah, that's not very far away indeed.
Wow.
That was when I was here in the research lab, and I was not really shooting lightning. I was just observing and taking data, so that doesn't really count. And then I had one time that I was also here in the research building, but I was shooting with a video camera. And then lightning struck, I would say, 80 feet away from me.
Oh, well, 80 feet's a mile away compared to 6
yeah,
feet, isn't it?
Yeah, that's far, right. Yeah, just hear thunder. You know, don't even hear explosion. Yeah.
Yeah. You talked about the research lab, and your professional life is devoted to weather. Tell me a little bit about what you do.
Right, so this research lab was built in the 1960s, specifically for lightning research and thunderstorms. So the place is called Langmuir Lab, and nowadays there's not many people at the lab. I'm in the remote sensing area of the research, I would say.
So what do you do?
What I'm doing is we have several instruments here, the most important being the lightning mapping array, and that consists of 10, 12 stations on the ground. They all record the signals from lightning flashes in clouds, cloud to ground, everything. And by analyzing all the data from all those 12 stations, you can figure out where the lightning was in the cloud. And not just the location of the bolt, but the location of every segment of the channel. So you can get a full 3D picture with time resolved of how the lightning was looking in the cloud.
So what are we hoping to learn from this research that you're doing?
Well, ultimately, we are looking after how get thunderstorms electrified the way they do. How does lightning start anyway? Because we have made measurements over the years in thunderstorms, just showing that the electric field never gets high enough to trigger lightning. So lightning obviously occurs, and we are wondering why. So that's one thing we can find out with that lightning mapping array, and there's other instruments I'm using too, you know, detect field changes during lightning flashes and all that. Gets technical pretty quick, but.
So your personal life is all centered around weather, or a lot of it is, and your professional life.
That's right, and I'm quite happy here. You know? I'm on the top of a mountain here, and
you see a
clouds
lot of,
all around me. Yeah.
You see a lot of thunderstorms where you are.
That's right, yeah. And
so yeah, when a storm pops up, you have to run to your desk right quick. What do you do?
Yeah, so most of my instruments are not like ready to take data right away. So when a storm comes here, I usually, you know, I look at the sky and I have usually like half hour notification that something is going to happen. And then I just rush to my desk and start up all the instruments and data taking, and then I sit at my computer, and it's not automatic altogether. It's I have to, you know, look at the data I'm getting and adjust settings accordingly. So it gets very busy.
It sounds like the weather is a real item of fascination for you.
Yeah, it is, yeah. It's I spent maybe half my life observing the skies, you know. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but... yeah.
You grew up in the Netherlands, and you're here in the States. How long will you remain in the States?
At least 2 more years, I think, yeah.
What do you think of U.S. weather?
Oh, I think it's a whole lot more interesting than in the Netherlands, yeah. The only thing is that in the Netherlands, where I lived further north, a higher latitude, and I got to see some kinds of weather there that I never see here.
Oh, really?
For instance, aurora I almost never see here, at least not as spectacular as there, and noctilucent clouds. Those are very nice, very beautiful, and you don't see them here.
Well, you have a huge array of pictures on your website, not just lightning, but what else have you got on there that people can look at?
I have some categories, so lightning, obviously, and then I have the common clouds. I try to catalog it as much as possible, so cloud type and all that, and forms. And then I have a whole section about atmospheric optics, and that includes halos, rainbows, glories, fog bows, and all these things. I don't know if that really appeals to many people, but once you you learn about those phenomena, it's and you get to see something that's very rare, it gives you really, you know, a special feeling, and that got me hooked.
It sounds to me like you're like us, Harold. You're a weather geek.
That's right, weather uber geek. All right.
All
yes,
right.
I am.
All
I
right.
won't deny that.
That's Harold Aidens in Socorro, New Mexico, who lives and works for Lightning. Harold's website, again, is weatherscapes.com. We'll put links to that and to the Langmuir Laboratory where he works on our website, weatherbrains.com. Another note about his website, guys, it's not just weather that he has photographs displayed there. He's got some space pictures, an international space station that he caught with a camera, and just all kinds of cool stuff and plenty of weather. Lots of cloud formations and astronomy, lightning, atmospheric phenomena. So it's a very interesting site. Quite an accomplished photographer and a pretty interesting and friendly fellow to talk with as well.
He is very personable and very interesting. I must check out his website.
It's impressive stuff. Now, JB, you shot you've done a lot of photography and you've had a business in photography. You have some experience shooting tough things like lightning.
Not to the extent of Harold, but I have shot quite a few, and I'm like him. I'm still with film. I have not gone digital yet, but with film, if you use ASA 25 or ASA 100, if you'll put your 35 millimeter camera on a tripod and with a cable release and leave the aperture on 5.6 or 8 and just leave it for a while, you can usually get a good picture with ASA 25 or ASA 100 film.
That's just got to be an amazing feeling, whether you shoot film or digital, to take a shot in a thunderstorm and see a bolt of lightning. And, you know, especially if you're shooting film, you don't know what you got right away, so you have to wait a while. And it must be a real thrill to see something close up and vivid that you catch just the way you want it to.
Right. ASA 25 Kodachrome film is very hard to find anymore, but it used to be the standard for ultra-fine grain, needle-sharp, and lasting effect, too. A Kodachrome color slide, if kept in proper storage, will show little or no color fade in 90 to 100 years.
So, Brian, what have you shot?
Well, I remember at Florida State, as a student, going up on the Love Building, which is where the meteorology department was.
We know what was going on up there.
And shooting lightning that was actually well south of Tallahassee. And it was so frustrating because I was shooting with a 35 millimeter film camera. But it was so frustrating because I'd point the camera and I'd open the exposure, you know, open the lens with a time exposure, and then lightning would be off to the left.
Absolutely.
So then it would close, and I'd turn over to the left, and I'd open it up, and then it would the lightning would fire off to the right.
I think that's called Murphy's Law.
That's Murphy's Law of lightning photography, I'm afraid. So.
Yeah, I guess ideally, if you had a perfect world, you'd be up on a mountaintop where you've got a tremendous long view that's unblocked, and maybe you've got some kind of a patio or something that's covered so you can, you know, see the big expanse of sky but be relatively safe, too. That would be the perfect world, I suppose. And
well, Harold's, I checked out his website, working on our WeatherBrains website, for the links tomorrow. I was making sure everything was right. I spent a half an hour this afternoon. I just wanted to make sure it was going to the right page, and I got so fascinated looking at his pictures.
Yeah.
And his pictures are from all over the world.
Yeah.
Too. I mean, he's got one that I thought was fascinating because of gravity waves over the British Isles from an airplane. It was like it's just any weather geek who likes photography and likes weather needs to go to his site and take a look.
Yeah, you can do some great stuff, and it does pay to be safe as well. Let's move on to the Weather Roundtable, where we just talk about items on our mind relating to weather. Mr. Elliott, what's on your agenda?
Brian mentioned earlier in this cast that it's very interesting because of the variations in weather geographically. And in a country as big as the United States, there's always a contrast. And when some parts of the country are having adverse weather of one type, it can be counterbalanced in other parts of the country. And I wanted to mention rainfall and temperature, and I'll go through these stats real fast because I know it's much more interesting to read stats than to listen to somebody rattle them off. So let's go first with some rain. Very wet in the central part of the country. Tulsa, 34 inches already this year, excess of 9.26. Oklahoma City has received 6.30 in July, 38.14 this year, and a surplus of 16.46. Dallas-Fort Worth, a surplus of 16.65. Austin, an excess of 19.61 inches.
Wow.
San Antonio, 18.95 inches above normal. And over on the other side of the country, New York City has an excess of over 10 inches for the year. Now, the bad news, Atlanta, 14.37 inches below normal. Huntsville, Alabama, about 21 inches below normal. Tuscaloosa, Alabama, close to 23 inches below normal. I think it's very interesting to note that Huntsville has had a deficiency of 50 inches since January 1, 2005. So they have lost an entire year supply of rainfall in the last 2.5 years. And Dallas-Fort Worth, no 100-degree weather this year. But I counted 20 locations in Montana today with highs 100 or hotter, including 106 in Sydney and 105 at Roundup, Montana. I love that name. But if you really want some dry weather, let's go out to Southern California, Los Angeles Airport. Only 0.01 this month, 1.67 all year. Long Beach has received only 1.20 inches all year. And Palmdale, California, only 1/3 of an inch of rain all year. They normally will get over 5 inches. That's the end of my story.
So in other words, if Brian Peters tells somebody in Tulsa or Austin, hey, I had almost half an inch of rain, they're going to be going, they're going to be going,
well, yeah, JB answered the question that I keep being asked. Where's our rain gone? Well, now we know.
Yeah,
it's in Texas, Oklahoma, and New York.
Yeah. It was stolen.
I think they, if they had the choice, they would be willing to give some of it up. And we don't have that option. Anyway, Brian, what's on your mind?
Well, David, I wanted to put in a plug that for spotters and weather geeks, I think it really is important. In my job at ABC 3340, I fill in, and I was filling in this weekend. And that report I mentioned about 4.7 inches was an actual person who emailed in. And I don't think they're a real weather geek. They're just a person that has apparently a little bit of interest because they went ahead and emailed that rainfall report in. But I really want to put in a plug. Wherever you are in the country, storm spotters, rainfall spotters, snow spotters, weather spotters in general are always needed. And I think that it's important that we remember that, yes, we're doing some wonderful things in the field of meteorology with remote sensing. And Harold was talking about being able to remotely sense and learn more about lightning. We're remotely sensing with radar, with automated surface observing. But guess what? Those things aren't everywhere. And we really need ground truth reports of all kinds of weather phenomena. So really encourage anybody listening to our program that if you, you know, contact your local National Weather Service or local media in your area, like our Sky Watcher program at ABC 3340, and go ahead and participate, because you never know when you're going to be in exactly the right spot where something big happens and nobody's going to know about it if you don't record it. So just put in a plug for weather spotters.
Well, and it's funny that you would mention them, Brian, because we've heard from some weather spotters in the Weather Brains email box this week, and I thought we would just say hello to some of those people. We heard this week from Jack Souter. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. He's an amateur radio operator, KC6IIH. He's a member of NOAA's Skywarn Spotter Network in Barstow, California, and he's a member of the Barstow Amateur Radio Club out there. Raymond Larrabee Jr., another ham, KB8ILD, from Grand Rapids, Michigan, contacted us. Thanks, Raymond. Thanks, too, to Dave Winsell in Charlotte, North Carolina, who heard about us on the Amateur Radio Newsline broadcasts there at arnewsline.org. He, too, is a ham radio operator and a Skywarn weather spotter. See, Brian, it's just like we had this all planned, but we really didn't. We didn't. You didn't know that. But
no, I didn't.
A lot of spotters, a lot of ham radio people listen to us. Also heard from Mary Howell in Summerton, Alabama. Thank you for contacting us, Mary. Finally, Chris Ayers, Columbia, Missouri, and Steve from Middleton, Delaware. So quite a scattering across the country of folks listening, and we do appreciate it.
Hey, well, David, before you leave that subject, you mentioned several of the folks were amateur radio operators, and one of the reasons that I think weather and amateur radio go very much together is that amateur radio, as part of the FCC licensing, requires that public service be done, and storm spotting, or let me broaden that to weather spotting, is one of those areas where amateur radio really can pay off and help out a lot. So you and I are both hams. JB, you're not a ham, are you? Well, you're hamming up, but.
He likes ham, but anyway, that's a different.
I love amateur radio, and I almost tried to get my license one time, but I just did not do it.
Well, JB's been around hams for years and years from his years at the National Weather Service, so you know what they're like to work with.
And, yeah, back in the 50s and 60s, we depended on ham radio operators almost entirely for storm spotters because there were no such thing as cell phones back then, and often the landlines would go down in a tornado, but the ham radio operators would always come through for us.
I think what's interesting, too, is you can ask the question in this day and age, what's the use of having a ham radio operator? Everybody has cell phones. But if you look at how the system works and the limitations contained within, if you go visit your local National Weather Service forecast office, for example, you're going to probably find that they don't have 25 lines, phone lines, and they don't have 25 people sitting there waiting to take phone calls. Their resources are a lot more limited. And amateur radio allows for the passing of a lot of information through trained communicators without having to fill up phone lines and get busy signals all the time. Is that not right, Brian?
That is absolutely correct. And weather nets, throughout my career in the National Weather Service, weather nets operate usually on a very local basis and report back then to the National Weather Service. So it's a very strong conduit for weather information to travel, even though we've got lots of other communications routes like government radio networks, 800 megahertz and cell phones and all that. Amateur radio still fills the bill often.
Yeah, if you're a weather geek listening to Weather Brains and you'd like to know more about amateur radio, if you're not involved in that, ARRL.org is a website to go to. That's the National Amateur Radio Organization. They're called the American Radio Relay League, and they're in Newington, Connecticut. And that's a good place that you can go to kind of find out some basics. Well, we know that temperature drops as you go up in the atmosphere, right? Well, that's not always true. There are some exceptions called inversions. We learn more about inversions from the illustrious Professor Peters, who brings us Weather Brains 101. And on This Week in Weather History, Bill Murray tells us about one of the deadliest natural disasters in American history. It struck Colorado. This is also the anniversary of a horrendous Texas air crash that had a direct connection to weather, and two hurricanes that pounded the Texas coast. It's all part of the Weather Center.
Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters.
The radiosondes that we spoke of last week produce one of the most valuable tools in meteorology, a thermodynamic profile of the atmosphere, often called SKU-Ts for the type of diagram used to plot the data. The temperature profile typically shows the temperature decreasing with height, at least through the troposphere. But sometimes there are levels in the atmosphere where the temperature actually increases with height. These are called inversions. There are several ways inversions can be created. High-pressure subsidence, or sinking air. Warm air advection in the middle levels of the troposphere. Radiational cooling of the Earth's surface. Warm air flowing over a large cold water body. A frontal inversion. And the ever-present tropopause inversion. Plotted soundings often contain a value called cap. This value tells the strength of the inversion in the low levels of the atmosphere. An inversion is most commonly found near the top of the planetary boundary layer or that transition zone of differential advection. The cap is important since it can both promote severe weather or prevent storms from forming. If the cap is too strong, parcels of air will not be able to rise above the cap. Since the cap is an inversion, a strong inversion of warm air prevents air from rising above the cap, since the air parcels become cooler than the environment when they reach the cap. On the other hand, the cap can trap moisture and heat in the planetary boundary layer that will gradually weaken the cap. The warmer and more humid the air gets, the weaker the cap will become. Once the cap is broken, explosive development of thunderstorms can occur. A general rule is that if the cap is greater than about 2.0 degrees centigrade, the cap will not be broken within the next few hours. Once the cap drops below 2.0, convection is likely to occur. Forecasting the cap accurately is often a key to a great forecast. Some days the cap will be too strong,
and will maintain itself, resulting in no storms, even in the heat of the day. These days are sometimes labeled busts and are one of the reasons why days with a moderate or high chances of severe storms end up with no convection at all. Guess I'll put on my cap and wind this up for another week. Remember, if you have questions about weather terms, send them to question@weatherbrains.com.
Let's take a look back at some interesting weather history for the week of July 31st through August 6th. July 31st, 1976, one of the worst flash floods in U.S. history occurred in the Big Thompson Canyon in Colorado. A huge thunderstorm remained stationary over the same area for hours, dumping as much as a foot of rain and sent a 20-foot wall of water roaring through the canyon. 139 people died. 6 people were never found. July 31st, 1980, Hurricane Allen was born. The powerful hurricane achieved Category 5 status 3 different times as it weaved and bobbed through the islands of the Caribbean and passed into the Gulf. It struck South Texas on August 10th as a Category 3 hurricane. And it was back on August 2nd, 1985, that Delta Flight 191 and L-1011 TriStar crashed on approach to the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport, killing 136 people on board and one person on the ground. The accident was caused by a microburst, a narrow blast of powerful winds coming from a strong thunderstorm. Back on August 3rd, 1970, Hurricane Celia struck near Corpus Christi, Texas, with sustained winds of 130 miles an hour. But a lot of the damage was caused by winds that gusted as high as 180 miles an hour. It's one of the most damaging hurricanes ever to strike the Texas coast. And continuing with the Texas thread, it was on August 4th, 1980, that Dallas finally saw its incredible string of 42 straight days of temperatures of 100 degrees or higher finally come to an end. The 1980 heat wave also killed nearly 1,200 people across the United States. And in 1949, the practice of parachuting firefighters in to battle a forest fire was relatively new. 13 smoke jumpers, though, were killed on August 5, 1949, when the Man Gulch fire in the Helena National Forest in Montana blew up. And on August 6, 1993, Virginia experienced its worst tornado outbreak. 3 people died in a Walmart store in Colonial Heights near Petersburg when the state's first F4 tornado in history was recorded. That's this week in weather history.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bill Murray. If you'd like to contact the Weather Geeks here at Weather Brains, we have an email address for you to do that with, the address being question@weatherbrains.com. Or if you feel so inclined to say hey in your own voice, you can do that too, courtesy of our toll-free voicemail telephone number, 1-888-247-8627. 1-888-247-8627. You could call in and say hey to the professor. For the Weather Brains crew, J.B. Elliott, Brian Peters, I'm David Black. Thank you for listening, and we hope you can join us again for the next edition of Weather Brains. Weather Brains is copyright 2007. All rights reserved. Adios. I guess we should have probably said Mr. Spann is on vaccination this time. Didn't think about that earlier. And Mr. Selly had some work commitments that he wasn't able to join us with. So anyway, maybe they'll be around next time.
And, you know, Bill's piece made me feel so old. I actually had some association with several of those different events that are
same here.
Now this week in weather history.
Yeah, same here. You know, I was thinking about the Delta crash in Dallas. I remember that very vividly. And I believe, and I'm sorry he's not with us on the show, I think James Spann was anchoring the weather for the CBS affiliate, I believe, in Dallas, KDFW. Not sure if it was CBS.
I was in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and saw the crash and didn't know it.
Really?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, I went out to get supper for the family, and on my way back, I saw this smoke plume over towards the airport.
Oh, my goodness.
Not realizing that it was the plane crash. I got home, got out of the car, and all of a sudden, the trees were bending low. We had 50-mile-an-hour winds from the microburst.
My word.
That had taken the airplane down, and then we turned it on the TV, and bam, all this coverage of the airplane crash. So,
and I remember I remember Hurricane Celia that Bill was talking about in that piece, too. I was a child in my hometown in Texas, and I remember hearing a radio reporter who was in Corpus Christi when that hurricane hit land, and he was several stories up in a hotel and he talked about the water in the commodes swishing back and forth. And I thought, man, that takes some power to do that. I have a very vivid memory of that from all that many years back. Anyway,
and I got assigned to Brownsville for Hurricane Allen.
It's just weird how all these things come back around.
Yeah.
Anyway, enjoy the
great show,
gentlemen.
Guys.
Thank you, guys. Had fun.
Okay.
Adios.
Y'all have a good week.
Bye. Good night.